20450, United States versus Wilbert McCreath. Mr. Clue. Mr. Clue, before you start, we know that you are court appointed, and on behalf of Judge Luck and Judge Legault and myself, I want to thank you very much for your service to us and to Mr. McCreath as well. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, thank you very much. This case comes to back to the court on from a limited remand. The court, in the initial a briefing and the supplemental briefing, initial supplemental briefing, it was clear that the district court had referenced a United States Probation Office analysis. We didn't know what that analysis was. We didn't know that it had occurred. And in fact, the district court's order was entered even prior to the defendant's original pro se reply on his motion for compassionate release. So the parties agreed that, because we didn't know whether there was new information in there, and because this court in the Jules case had said that that's really the focus, is whether the court's relying on new information, that a limited remand to the district court would be appropriate to consider what's in the report. Is it new information? And the district court on remand appointed me to represent Mr. McCreath to file a response to what was clearly new information in the probation analysis. So I pointed out in the response that it was new information, that it tied in directly both to the court's reference to the analysis and to the specific part of the court's original order dealing with the defendant's prison record and adjustment in prison life. And in fact, it had a full page of what we consider to be erroneous and misrepresented information about that in the report. So given that, the government filed its response in which it conceded that the district court clearly had relied on the information in the probation report, because it was no other reasonable way to read the original order and the analysis in the original order. They contested, however, our raising additional points about the compassion, the additional 3553A factors.
Counsel, the limited remand order that had an additional question other than just the new information issue, which you're discussing right now, specifically asked whether the district court had relied on the probation analysis, correct?
Again, the emphasis on the motion was, and the order from this court was to grant the motion. The emphasis on the motion, including the word given the highlight, was relied on new information. I believe
it also asked whether,
yes,
it had relied on that new information, and if so, what that new information was, and allow an opportunity to respond to it. Right, that was the impetus of the limited remand. Correct.
Right. There was a little bit of a uncertainty of exactly what the remand encompassed, because
but the motion specifically says, and the remand order says, it's on a limited basis for further proceedings as outlined in the motion. And the motion specifically says the parties jointly request, because you both requested it, a limited remand to the district court for disclosure of probation's analysis and for the district court to clarify whether it actually relied on new information in denying McCreath's motion. And then obviously, and to respond to any new information contained in the U.S. probation analysis, if appropriate.
Right, I think that and respond part, it was in one paragraph of the motion. It wasn't in the concluding relief paragraph of the motion. It was unclear. The district court on its own ordered the parties to respond. So that
But back to the question that I asked and that Judge Legault has specifically highlighted, the district court then came back and said, hey, I didn't rely on this thing, right?
The district court said that it did not rely on the report. And it said, in fact, that it had never relied on new information in a probation report. And it said that when the only thing it uses the probation report for, apparently, is its recommendation. And if the government opposes or favors, and then the probation office doesn't, that none of the analysis matters to the court. It's just what they say they want. And if they don't want the same thing, then the court appoints counsel and goes forward.
Do we have any reason to doubt the district court's representation that it didn't rely on the information?
Well, we certainly have the government's filing in the district court that said unequivocally that it was clear that it did rely on that information when we have the order itself.
I'm not concerned about the government's belief. Do we have any reason to doubt the district court's representation to this court on a specific remand to us that when it says it didn't rely on it, that it didn't?
We have no reason at all to doubt Judge Middlebrook's sincerity. I would be the last person to do that with any district judge here, but certainly, absolutely not. However, these words have a very flexible meaning and understanding. And Jules used, you know, this concept of reliance on new information, but the focus was, is the information new? And thus, the premise of the response responding to it was that if you're going to order a response to it, you must be considering it. So that it's sort of a contradiction inherent in it.
But Jules also allowed, which I assume is reason why the joint motion for limited remand was phrased as it was, the carve out that if the district court did not rely on the new information, of course, there's nothing to do. Right?
Absolutely. And certainly as a theoretical matter. And a lot of these things, of course, a lot of things in law.
This isn't theoretical. This is what actually happened. We sent it back. The district court told us I didn't rely on it. If we have no reason to doubt that, and I think you're wise to say that here we don't, both given the specific district court here and in general, I'm hard pressed from our perspective to say, well, that's wrong, and we have to look beyond that, rather than just say they didn't rely on it, so there's no harm, no foul here.
Well, I think there's a lot in that I would like to address. And again, I do not question the district court's sincerity, but the district court, in its order, said, after reviewing the probation office's analysis and citing the only thing the district court cited in its order was the discussion of disciplinary history by the defendant, which is the primary new information in the probation officer's analysis. Then the district court asks both parties to respond. The government concedes it's obvious the district court must have relied on it. How could the district court not have? It would have been very strange for a district court not to at least review it and consider it. Now, for the district court to say, I'm discounting it in my decision-making process, I'm discounting the individual facts is one thing, but again, you're asking the district court to go back in time years after the fact when he has put in his order that he's relying on the defendant's history of violence, and that's what's in the report.
We do that all the time. In Beeman, for example, we have district courts go back 10, 20 years to see what it did and what it thought at the time, whether it was relying on the residual clause or not, and we rely on those findings all the time. I don't see, this was, as I understand it, 6 months, not even 6 months earlier. Why can't the district court say, I remember, and I didn't rely on it?
It was, I believe, considerably longer than that, Your Honor.
A year?
I think it was at least a year.
Okay.
I'm going to have to go back to make sure. But again, the question of whether a district court focuses on the factors that he considers important to the, or she considers important to the decision, is certainly one factor.
Can I just turn you for a second, because your time is running out, and I want to get to the second issue, which I think is also relevant. So let's assume that the district court relied on the probation officer's submission the first go around. And let's say that, notwithstanding what Judge Luck just discussed with you, that we disregard the district court statement that it didn't rely on that probation office submission the first go around. Okay? So you now had a chance to respond on remand to what the probation officer provided. And the district court's order, although it's brief, it says that there are still no compelling and extraordinary reasons. It says that it's relying in part on the nature of the offense and the history of violence, and those things weigh heavily against release. And then the district court adds at the end that the new health conditions provided by Mr. McCreath don't change its mind or its decision. So, how do you show that that is an abuse of discretion, given that confluence of factors?
The new findings with regard to compassionate release. The first problem with the analysis is that it really is not clear what the district court is saying. He's still not saying I'm limited to the policy statement factors, or I'm not limited to the policy statement factors. It's sort of amorphous in terms of what the district court's saying. The district court discusses, again, his practice in other cases, which was to avoid the issue. He doesn't say whether he avoided the issue in this case or not, but the implication is that he avoided the issue of whether there is any way of getting around the policy statements or not. So the other part about it, I think, is the beginning part of the court's question, which is we do have a different time frame now. Now we don't just have the analysis and the report. We have the responses. We have the fighting back and forth between the parties. We have the argument. Now the district court is saying, I'm not only not considering the probation officer's analysis, I'm not considering what the parties are telling me now. So at that point, if we are looking at this as a new decision, then we do have a problem from a discretion standpoint. This should have been looked at if that's because at that point it is material. And it's part of the case at that point.
But making it material doesn't mean that the district court has to weigh it significantly one way or another.
Again, it's the nature of the order was amorphous because the nature of Jules is a little bit amorphous. And the resulting order makes it unclear exactly what channeled the district court, what he means by history of violence, and it makes the record unclear. Can I come forward and say in this court now that when he says history of violence, no, the allegations made in the probation analysis were incorrect? I don't know. Is that excluded completely from the case? I don't know. It seems in this case, probably we made a mistake in asking for the limited remand. The better course would have just been remand and start over.
All right, Mr. Clue, thank you very much. You've saved your full time for rebuttal. Ms. Hoffman.
Good morning, Your Honors. Andrea Hoffman on behalf of the United States. I'd like to start with focusing on the Jules issue just briefly. Jules stands for the premises, Judge Luck was saying, that if a district court relies upon new information, the parties have a right to address, know what that information is and address it. Rely is the key term. And reliance means that you have acted upon someone's statements, facts, claims. There's an action, a use requirement in reliance, not an awareness or a review or even a consideration of, it's use of. And this court has told, the district court has told this court very clearly in response to a very specific limited remand that they did not rely.
I mean, I take Judge Luck's point, and I think he's probably right, that there's nothing for us to use or to have to discredit the district court statement. But I also understand, Mr. Clue's predicament, because you've got a district court specifically at least citing the probation officer's submission the first time around, which means that the district court at least saw it.
Without question.
And if you saw something, does that mean you didn't consider it? It doesn't mean that you weighed it, but it means that you looked at it. And so that puts a litigant like Mr. Clue's client in a really tough position, because what is he supposed to do? I mean, everybody thought when the case came up the first time around that it had to go back down because a district court, at least on its face, had said, in consideration of certain things, including the probation officer's submission, motion denied. And now the court is saying, I didn't rely on it. So, I mean, how do you make sense of all that?
There is actually a somewhat easy way to make sense of it, Your Honor. At page 54 of Mr. Clue's appendix is the Bureau of Prisons' response to the initial request that was the administrative request that was required way back in November of 2019. And the prison information that is now new in the probation analysis is entirely set forward in that page. All nine incidences, the fact that there was violence involved with them, the fact that there were different characters of involvements. So, and that is in fact what the district court quoted in its initial order at 233. So the court's statement now that it didn't rely is perfectly plausible, because what it was relying upon and what it did quote is in the record and was the initial, it's actually the second time this was denied to this defendant, but it was already in the record. So the fact that the court then reaffirmed in response to the joint remand from all of us, isn't quite as... Did the
government take as a given on the limited remand that the district court had relied on it? Mr. Clue says yes.
The government has says in the district court, in the trial proceeding, the district court says, the government says at some point that it concedes that the court relied. It does use that phrase in one line of it in late in the conclusion of it. They
What do we do with that?
I think, as you said a minute ago, it's not in fact relevant. Whether the government thinks the court relied or not is not material. The secondary point to this, though,
is... I don't want to put words in your mouth, but the way I would phrase it is, it's not determinative, but it might be relevant.
Better answer, probably, Your Honor. I thank you. The real reason why it's not determinative, though, is the point of Jules is that if there's new information, the parties have to have an opportunity to respond to it. That happened. The court, even though it knew it was going to say, I didn't rely on this, still gave everybody the memo, gave everybody a opportunity to respond. Everybody did. The court saw everybody's analyses. It may have rejected Mr. Clue's arguments in the district court. It may have...
But does that hamstring... I think Judge Jordan went through this line of questioning with Mr. Clue. Doesn't that hamstring the defendant? Because the normal procedure or posture would be this would be disclosed up front and everyone would have an opportunity, and the defendant could then raise additional claims in support of compassionate release, or at least respond. On this limited remand, it really didn't give the opportunity to file a robust motion and a robust response that could raise additional claims. In fact, the district court believed that it was constrained to not allow him to raise additional claims, right?
I actually respectfully would disagree with you, Your Honor. The court didn't make that decision. It didn't say we can't consider these. The court walked through the new claims raised by the defendants, the claims raised by the government.
But what the district court said is, as I understand a limited remand, is it what you're asking me is out now, this new medical issue is now outside the scope. But even if it wasn't outside the scope, it would not change my decision, right?
It did say that with respect to the medical issue, Your Honor. The medical issue wasn't presented. I mean, the medical issue is outside of the scope no matter what.
That's the problem. I think that's the issue. And that seems to be what your opposing counsel is talking about, which is because of how this was proceeded. In other words, if this was all done right in the beginning, the way it would have happened is the probation analysis would have been provided up front to the parties. Everyone would have had a full opportunity to air out all the things that needed to be aired out, including any possible additional grounds or claims, and it would have come up to us in a direct appeal.
It wouldn't have, Your Honor, because this was filed in, and I don't mean to correct, but it was filed in January of 2019. COVID hadn't happened yet. We weren't in the pandemic. So the initial order is issued in February of 2019. So the health concerns don't exist. The district court, and that's a letter motion that happens. Then there's the Bureau of Prisons denial that happens in November of 2019. We're still before the pandemic. Then the district court, he files the motion for compassionate release in November of 2019. It's denied in January of 2020. We're still before the pandemic. The appellate briefing is fully done in February of 28th. The pandemic send us all home sort of order in Miami was March 13th or 15th of 2020. All of this was briefed before that happened. The government's response was about a week later. So when the limited remand happens, the defendant has unlimited opportunity to bring a compassionate release motion. He must exhaust. That's without question. So the COVID issues, to the extent that he wanted to bring them, had to happen in a second motion. It had to go to the Bureau of Prisons first, no matter what. The court doesn't address that at the district court level, but it's readily resolvable. And the government does raise the timing issue and the exhaustion issue. So the COVID factors weren't a part of this analysis in either of the contexts because it came up before it happened. So you know, if the defendant wanted to bring a COVID compassionate release motion tomorrow, he can. That there's no, you know, one bite at the apple type of thing for those issues. So I don't think that the defendant is in sort of a, I'm going to use a colloquial phrase, a trick bag here, where he's caught between, you know, where he can't win for losing kind of thing. That's not the circumstance because The only issue that was arguably new was the COVID one. The court said it wouldn't change its analysis, but the defendant can bring it repetitively, and unfortunately for this defendant, he has a lot of years to go. He can bring that again if he needs to.
All right, let's talk about the alternative way to look at this case, which is ignore whether or not the district court relied on the probation officer's submission. Assume, even if it's not the right assumption or the best assumption, that the district court did, in fact, rely on it. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the merits of the district court's decision. What's your response there?
As to the merits of the district court decision, there are two opinions by this court that resolve these matters solidly, both Bryant and Heron. Under Bryant, the question of whether the 1B1.13 set policy provision is controlling in this case has been resolved, and it is. The district court's decision, whether or not he was 100% clear to Mr. Clue's consideration about whether he used that policy decision or not, you're obligated to. And Bryant resolved the question of the 403 First Step Act stacking changes in law are not retroactive and they're not an extraordinary and compelling circumstance. So substantively, Bryant resolves this case. Heron then resolves it yet again in a different manner, because in this court's opinion in Heron, the decisions are that you have to have the extraordinary and compelling circumstances, you have to show that the reduction would be consistent with the applicable policy statement, and you have to address 3553 factors. However, Heron makes it clear that you don't have to do that in any order, and you don't have to do all three of them if any one of them doesn't exist, because all three are required. There's sort of a fourth element, because under the 3553 and the 1B113 issues, there's the whole question of a danger to community. So those four things are critical. Both of this district court's orders make it clear that it doesn't meet the 3553 factors and or the danger to the community. Setting aside, let's assume for a moment that he met extraordinary and compelling on some theory. The COVID one, we'll just throw it out there for a second. He doesn't meet it on the 3553 factors or the danger to the community for this district court, and the court didn't abuse its discretion in making that determination. When you have a defendant that had 7 armed robberies in this instant conviction, 3 uses of a firearm in the commission of a crime of violence, and 2 felon in possession of a firearms, in this offense alone, the level of violence, the nature and circumstance of this crime, then you have the history and characteristics of this defendant who has prior convictions for the same sort of offenses, has a supervised release revocation for armed robbery, has 9 prison offenses that involve violence or possessions of weapons inside a prison context. All of those clearly demonstrate that this defendant, his history and characteristics, the nature and circumstance of the offense, would, as the Bureau of Prisons, be inappropriate to give a release at that at this time, and would minimize the severity of his offense and his characteristics, would serve no form of deterrence, wouldn't promote respect for the law. All of those aren't said in the classic every word of the 3553 factors, but all of those factors that I've just discussed are in both orders. So in that context, the defendant loses both procedurally under Jules, there's no reason for a further remand. Substantively under Bryant and Heron, the district court clearly did not abuse its discretion.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The court, as the government indicated, quoted a provision that was submitted by the warden and the government cited the appendix page of our appendix. That paragraph, which is quoted, is not the same as the page-long description and analysis given in the probation office. So they're two different things. And the fact that they complement each other and one explains the other and amplifies the other, I think, is against the notion that the fact of the one supersedes the fact of the other. The government has moved its exhaustion argument forward another step in court today that I don't think any court has previously adopted, which is that while a compassionate release motion is pending before the district court, if additional factors and evidence becomes relevant to the consideration of the compassionate release motion, the government is saying, no, you can't even mention those factors because any additional consideration relevant to the compassionate release decision has to first be sent to the Bureau of Prisons. Certainly the statute doesn't say that. That would be a really a novel application of administrative exhaustion in the context of 3582 motions. It would be perfectly appropriate and is probably the case in every single 3582 motion that comes before this court, particularly after counsel is appointed, that additional amplification or description of factors or additional medical or new medical events occur. Almost every one of these cases, you have a new medical event coming up in the compassionate release motion. To say that there's got to be an administrative exhaustion for every new thing that happens medically is outside the bounds of any case. So what you have then is a situation where the district court proceeded in a way to say that response to the material was needed. The district court heard response to the material. There was competing advocacy about those responses and no resolution of the advocacy. It was so clear to everyone in the initial proceeding that the government conceded that the district court clearly had relied on the report because he said it relied on the report, did not specify limit its discussion of history of violence to some criminal record because the criminal record, again, there's no actual violence. There's a technical crime of violence a label that's put on a bank robbery if you have a firearm. But there's no history of it was described in the order of commission of violence other than the allegations of the warden, which we were able to finally, when we see the factual allegations in the probation report, respond to. But again, the district court makes no resolution of those. So
I take your point, but armed bank robbery is certainly a crime that has a huge potential for violence, even if you don't consider it intrinsically to be a violent offense. It's not like going into a bank, as wrong as it is, and slipping the teller a note, but you're not armed. That's a different sort of situation.
I certainly wouldn't do it. I guarantee you. My point is that the district court separated out these two concepts. He separated out the nature of the offense and a history of violence after just quoting this summary from the warden, which is then explained in the probation officer's report. So for everybody to conclude that the district court must have, after saying you review the report, after quoting the parts relevant to it, after talking about the history of violence apart from the nature of the offense, the district court must have meant something other than what Jules is talking about. Because even the district court thought that there needed to be a response, but the district court then didn't resolve it. And once it is resolved, and once it's on the table, and once it is material to what the district court is resolving, the better course is for a full remand so that you can completely flesh out all of these things. And I don't mean to diminish armed bank robbery, but I mean, I have had armed bank robbers, you know, sentenced to 3 years in the course of my representation, it's a serious offense, but I don't know. There's a lot of people with armed bank robbery convictions that got compassionate release. That's my only point. I didn't mean to diminish the...
No, I understand, Mr. Clue. I understand that all cases are different and all defendants are different and they all have to be analyzed on their own basic set of facts. So, okay. Thank you very much.
Just want to make sure that I am preserving my Bryant issue for further review. The court understands.
Yeah, everything that you've put in the brief is preserved. We have a lot of lawyers who think that we're out of step with Bryant, but that's the law of our circuit. You've certainly preserved your position that you think we got that case wrong.
Thank you, Your Honor, very much.
Thank you both.
Thank you both very much.